Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Welcome back. Next, we usually go around the room and say our names. I'll start. I'm George.
My name is Stefan.
My name is Mark.
My name is Ray.
I'm Larry.
I'm Flint.
Jeff.
Bob.
Jack.
I'm Lee.
Don.
My name is Cass.
Ernie.
Mario.
Kalan.
David.
My name is Hunter.
My name is Michael.
Greg.
In the back.
Good.
Peter,
John,
Mikhail,
Jay.
And other than Mikhail, is anyone else here for the first time, returning after a long absence? Okay. I didn't get the memo that we were going to have a speaker today. I thought it was open discussion, so I was prepared for that and not for this. So I don't have, and I'm not tech savvy, so I don't have an iPhone to introduce David, but I will tell you that my experience of David over the years that I've been coming to this sangha is that he exudes Buddha nature. He's facilitated our retreats, he's been a sangha member for many years, and he has it. He has all my teachers and all the sanghas I've belonged to over the years have taught me that you aspire to have Buddha nature. David has that. Thank you, David, for being here.
Thank you, George.
That's the nicest introduction I've ever had.
The ones who write for ourselves are so full of ego. Mine got longer and longer and longer over the years, and finally, last year, I think I edited it down to two sentences. Like, David loves the Dharma. I feel so much better about it. But it was not as good as that. Thank you. So, in the interest of transparency, because I might be a little ditzy today, I want to share that I'm in some pain. Not really horrible pain. So has anybody ever had gout in this room? You don't have to put your hand up, because people are embarrassed about that, including myself. It's usually associated with alcohol overuse or poor diet. But in my case, it's a side effect of medications. And, every few years, I have a gout attack. That it's one of the most painful things I've ever experienced. But it's temporary, and it passes. And I'm familiar with it. But it kept me up most of the night. I didn't get much sleep, and I woke up not sure I could step out of bed this morning. And then I took a bunch of painkillers, and I'm kind of under control, but might be a little ditzy, and it wouldn't be beyond me to yelp in the middle of the talk. I'm just letting you know. Well, thank you. Oh, the other thing is I'm probably going to stick stricter to my script, because I don't trust my memory and my mind under these conditions. So I apologize for that. And I should, if I was a really good teacher, I'd be talking about working with pain today. But I didn't prepare a talk about working with pain, so I'm not sure I could do it, but maybe another time. What I have been working on, what's been alive in my practice, and I like to talk about what's alive in my practice when I'm giving Dharma talks, is death. Particularly Dia de los Muertos, which is coming up next week. Since the AIDS epidemic, I've been building a Dia de los Muertos altar every year. friends and comrades and family, compatriots who have passed on. And every year I rebuild it and take it down and put up pictures of all the people that I have pictures of who have passed away and things that they liked. I don't generally keep pictures around my house, my apartment, a lot, because I tend to find pictures that are always there. I stop looking at them after a point. They just kind of become visible. Never notice that. So there's something really special and heartfelt about pulling out people's photos once a year and putting them on my Dia de los Muertos altar and honoring them. The tradition of acknowledge your ancestors is pretty much universal. Most cultures that I'm aware of have a day or a week or a holiday where you acknowledge ancestors. So whether or not you have a relationship with your family, still have a relationship with your family, you're carrying those genes, those ancestors. Somebody gave me a DNA kit a couple of years ago as a present. The only interesting thing about my DNA was that I have a higher than average amount of Neanderthal in me, which I've decided to be proud of, my Neanderthal heritage. But when I think about my ancestors, it goes all the way back to the Neanderthals. So it's a universal tradition. And I just learned this morning that there's a holiday in India for around this time of year for ancestors. This Dia de los Muertos is Mexico. The Chinese honor their ancestors. There's Pixar Pictures made a really wonderful movie about Dia de los Muertos a couple of years ago called Coco. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's a really wonderful movie. It's as appealing to adults as it is for kids. It's called Coco, and I think it's streaming on Netflix. So, you know, maybe even on Dia de los Muertos this year. I'm going to watch it, so I invite you to also. In Coco, it's animated. And one of the wonderful things that they incorporated in that film is they showed the lives, the lives of people who have died, the existence of people on the other side, and animals, people and animals. And one of the things that was kind of magical about the way Pixar dealt with it is that if people and animals in the film that weren't being remembered by living people in the world started to lose their substance on the other side, started to lose their bones and their bodies, and they just kind of started to gradually disappear. Unless somebody lit a candle or remember them, in which case they would come back again. Kind of metaphorically symbolizing what happens with people in our memory. They kind of fade away and they come back. And so that's why I think it's so important to honor our ancestors. And in the gay community, and particularly for my Dia de los Muertos altar, as people who passed away in the AIDS epidemic, that's when I started building my altar. And those are our ancestors. And the world we live in today, especially here in San Francisco, is the legacy of those ancestors. Those are the people that came before us. And I think it's really important to remember them, if not all the time, at least once a year, and to acknowledge that we have gay ancestors in our community. One of the things as I was building my altar this year, which started yesterday, and I'm not done with it, so I'll be working on it for a few days. One of the things I realized is that I don't grieve for those people anymore. I felt a lot of grief at the time. And when I first lose somebody, I feel grief, but enough time passed away, I don't feel grief so much. I just feel a deep appreciation and fond memories. It's not that grief is bad, but the Buddha notably didn't grieve, including for some of his closest followers who passed away. Because the Buddha said, and people would ask him about this, the Buddha said that if you really understand impermanence, death is not surprising, nor is it terrible. It's simply nature. It's the nature of things. So when people died, Buddha appreciated them, talked about them, honored them, and when he was talking to groups, but claimed that he didn't grieve. I'm not at that state of enlightenment, unfortunately. I'm still grieving for our friend Hal Hershey, who died so long ago. He used so much of this sangha. But the day will come, I think, when I no longer grieve for Hal. I just appreciate it. Remember him as a good friend. He'll be on my altar this year. Death is a lesson, as the Buddha pointed out, in nature. Death is nature, in impermanence, in unreliability. That's dukkha. My favorite translation, I may have talked about this before, for the first noble truth, is unreliability of this human existence. The core truth of this human existence is unreliability. Buddha taught that this is a skillful reflection, reflecting on unreliability and reflecting on death, the inevitability of death. It's done in the monasteries every day. His teaching arose from an insight into what he called the heavenly messengers, old age, illness, and death. You've probably heard the story a bunch of times. I've probably told it here, the Buddha's encounter of old age, illness, and death. The legend goes, and I'll try not to draw it out too much, is that he was a pampered prince, and his father, who was a ruler in this country, protected him from the realities of life, gave him everything he wanted, pampered him, and he wasn't exposed to old age, illness, and death. That's a remarkable metaphor for our own age, because we're not either. We shuttle away people that are sick into hospitals and old people in nursing homes, and dying is pretty much a taboo. But, you know, we don't like to look at it in our culture. We're pampered princes too. In the story, the Buddha's escaped the palace one night with his charioteer, and his charioteer drove him through the streets, and he saw an old person. He saw an ill person, and he saw a dead body. And he didn't know what these things were. And that was his moment his early moment of waking up to the real nature of human life. I just read a commentary by a leading Buddhist translator of the Pali language, a Buddhist scholar, who said, you know, that sounds like a myth, and it is a myth. What comes out is studying the early scriptures is that the Buddha simply had insights. He was a 29-year-old, very intelligent, spiritually inclined young man who had an insight into old age, illness, and death, and came to realize that these were his personal, primary preoccupations, that his fear in life, what was holding him back from waking up, was fear of old age, illness, and death, and that these were universal fears. And so he set out on a spiritual quest to overcome that fear. So in the scriptures, when it's often said the Buddha overcame old age, illness, and death, what this translator, Analia, said, that's actually referring to is the Buddha overcame his fear of old age, illness, and death. So, if this topic's making you uncomfortable, you're not alone. It's pretty much universal. Buddha devoted the rest of his life into answering these questions and overcoming the crippling fear. One practice that you recommended is reciting the five remembrances, which advocates facing our fears directly. These five remembrances are chanted in monasteries and nunneries every single day. Buddhist monasteries and nunneries every single day. And they are: I am subject to aging. I cannot avoid aging. I am subject to illness. I cannot avoid illness. I am subject to death. I cannot avoid death. I am the owner of my karma. Karma is actions. I am the owner of my karma, the heir of my actions, born of my actions. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, of these I shall become the heir. So those five remembrances are chanted in monasteries. And I know I don't chant them every day, but I've gone through periods of time where 3-6 months at a time, I recite them every day, beginning my meditation. So this is for lay people as well, reflecting on the inevitability of old age and illness and death every day. Is one way that we can temper our fear, which we might not even be aware of. The last of those reflections, I am the owner of the karma. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, of these I shall become the heir, takes us back again to the theme of inheritance. But we don't inherit from our ancestors. We inherit from our actions, from our karma. Our happiness or our unhappiness are born out of our intentions and our actions. This is the law of karma. What we refer to generally, it's karma in the modern world, is generally what we're talking about is a combination of our past karma, our past actions, which cannot be changed. They're set in time. Plus, our current intentions and actions. What we're doing in this moment, our intentions and actions. So in every moment of our lives, we're planting the seeds for either happiness or unhappiness. We're planting the seeds for our future karma. So if you want to know who you are, look at your past actions. If you want to know who you will be, look at your present intentions and actions. So while Buddhists and many other religions and different cultures take time to honor ancestors and to remember the inevitability of mortality, happiness is only created or blocked in the present moment. This is the Buddha's enlightening insight, as expressed in the Four Noble Truths. Life is unreliable, the First Noble Truth. Our reaction to this constant unreliability and uncertainty and impermanence is suffering. That's the second double truth. Trying to control our experience. Second double truth. Freedom from suffering, the third noble truth, requires letting go of our attachment to permanence, to control, to having things be a certain way. And then, in the fourth noble truth, the Buddha defined a path for achieving freedom that has been practiced by monastics and lay people for 2,600 years. Try it true. This is our Buddhist inheritance, the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. The Buddha taught that the best time of your life is not in the past, not in the future, but right now. In this very moment. Sitting here in this room, in this very moment, this is the very best time in your life because this is the present moment. And now, this one. Sam Harris said, "It's how we pay attention to the present moment that largely determines the quality of our lives." So thoughts about the past or the future are just thoughts. And they're often unreliable. They're often dukkha. Thoughts of our past are conditioned by our preferences, what we choose to remember, what we choose not to remember, what becomes subconscious. Memories, highly unreliable. Certainly in my case, my memories are highly unreliable. And while we know that we're going to reach old age and die, eventually. We don't know how that's going to happen or when. So the future's unknown as well, even more unreliable than the past. The future is unknowable. The good news is that peace and happiness are available in any moment, in any present moment, no matter what's going on in your life. And one of the things I've been reflecting on last night as I was laying awake, because I couldn't go to sleep because pain was jolting me awake, was that I had a kind of underlying basic contentment. I'm okay with things the way they are. I wish the pain would go away, but it's not. It's with me for a while. But I can have peace and contentment along with the pain. That's the fruits of practice, for me, anyway. So peace is available no matter what's going on in your life. You don't have to have all the conditions for happiness lined up in just the right way. You don't have to have your ducks in a row to be happy. Happiness can happen no matter what's going on in your life if you're simply appreciating the present moment, whatever it offers. Nothing left out, including pain. Including sadness, including grief, can still have peace and contentment. So, with karma, we can plant the seeds for happiness for the future. They may or may not take root, but happiness only happens in the present moment. Achan Cha, who was a famous Thai meditation master in the mid-20th century, said this. This is kind of seasonal. This is a beautiful quote. Our lives are like the breath, like the growing and falling leaves. When we can really understand about falling leaves, we can sweep the paths every day and have great happiness in our lives on this changing earth. Our lives are like the breath, like the growing and falling leaves. When we can really understand about falling leaves, we can sweep the paths every day and have great happiness in our lives on this changing earth. We're all just falling leaves. Or as Ram Dass said, we're all just walking each other home. So there's great promise in the practices that the Buddha offered. Promise of contentment, peace, promise of freedom from suffering. Available to anybody, everybody. Happiness is born from wisdom. But as Thich Nhat Hanh taught, wisdom does not arise from thinking. Wisdom does not arise from thinking. This is the most radical aspect, I think, of the Buddha's teaching. Wisdom arises from mindfulness, from noticing what's going on in the present moment, not thinking about it. It's a much more simpler process, noticing, than thinking. And we can be fully present with our senses, eyes, ears, nose, smell, taste, touch. It's a much more immediate experience at the present moment than thinking. Wisdom does not arise from thinking. Wisdom arises from noticing, which is why meditation is such an important practice that the Buddha offered, so core to this, to Buddhist practice. This is not a belief system, Buddhism. We don't have dogma in Buddhism. Well, most of us don't. It's a practice that you either do or you don't. It's a practice of noticing rather than thinking. When we meditate, we let thinking fade into the background. We don't obliterate it. Thinking's not. You probably noticed in your meditation, it's pretty difficult to simply stop thinking. We can let it fade into the background. We cannot give it energy. We cannot feed it. Thought arises and passes just as quickly as a noise, as a click of a door or a squeak of a chair. Thoughts come and go just as quickly if we don't engage with them. The problem is we habitually engage with thoughts. So we get caught up in them, and then thoughts become stories, and stories become whatever, our day's preoccupation. When we meditate, we notice. We simply notice. leaving nothing out. It's including noticing thoughts arising and passing, noticing thoughts and arising. And noticing a thought arising is different than thinking that thought, two different activities. Without judging, and without trying to control our experience. The root word of mindfulness in Pali is sati, S-A-T-I, means mindfulness in the Pali language, the language of Buddha's time. I believe in Sanskrit also, you might be wrong about that. In Pali, its Pali's root word is remembrance, remembering. Not remembering the past, but remembering to be present. So, coming back full circle to the idea of remembering. That's what we do when we meditate. We remember to be present. And you may, if you meditate in the same way that I do, you might remind yourself many times during the course of meditation to, oh, my mind's drifted off. Come back to the present. Come back to the body. Come back to the breath. Each one of those is triggered by a reminder. A small moment of awakening that happens in mindfulness. Oh, I realize that I've gotten carried away with thoughts, or I've gotten carried away with some story or some plan. You notice that's happened, you let go of it. Third noble truth, you let go. You bring your attention back to the breath or the body, and you start all over again. Meditating is remembering to be present over and over and over again, as many times as it takes. That might be your entire meditation is drifting off and coming back 50 or 60 times. That starts to spill over in everyday life as well, not just our meditation cushion. We can be mindful in everyday life. Because if and when we can train ourselves to be mindful, to truly accept the impermanent and unreliable nature of life, the outcome is freedom from fear. This is how we gain freedom from fear. This is how we become free. Sally Tisdale says, "Know that your precious, infinitely beloved, and irreplaceable self will dissolve like a sandcastle, grain by grain. And what a relief it is to know. You exist in a great space of knowing, filled with a share of ephemerality of all things." That was a big word. So I'll repeat it if I can. Know that your precious, infinitely beloved, and irreplaceable self will dissolve like a sandcastle, grain by grain. And what a relief it is to know. You exist in a great space of knowing, filled with the shared ephemerality of all things. So peace and happiness are the karmic fruits of mindfulness practice. So I'd like to conclude with the last words of the Buddha, the last words he said to his Sangha as he died. "Behold, old monks, this is my last advice to you. All conditioned things in the world are changeable. They are not lasting. Practice diligently to gain your own salvation." That's the Buddha's invitation to us. That's what Buddhists have been doing for 2,600 years. So, thank you for your kind attention, and hoping to leave some time. Got plenty of time for discussion in the Sangha.
David, could you read that last line one more time?
The Buddha's last words. "Behold, O monks, this is my last advice to you. All conditioned things, this body, in the world are changeable. They are not lasting. Practice diligently to gain your own salvation." So what he's saying there, I believe, is if you want to be free from suffering, and when the Buddha was 29, that suffering meant prevent fear of old age, illness, and death. If you want to be free, practice mindfulness. Practice the five remembrances and train your mind away from fear, because death is the most natural thing in the world, as is old age and illness. We don't have to hide. We don't have to sublimate. We don't have to pretend like it's not going to happen to us, although we pretty much universally do. If we can let go of our fear, that's not a problem. Say, I just reminded myself another piece of wisdom I heard from this translator, Benaglio. I did sat a retreat with him earlier this year. And he's written a book about working with old age, illness, and death, and how it shows up in the scriptures. And he gave a talk on the last day of the retreat about climate change and global warming. And he said that his perception, he perceives that the core problem of global warming in our world is that we're all in denial about it. And he said it's exactly the same denial we have about our own deaths, is that it's such a scary thing that we don't let our minds go there. There's a psychological term for it, so it has something to do with panic. Does it ring a bell to you, Michael? We're mostly in denial about our own deaths, our own old age, because it brings up fear with us. And so we turn away from that. That's not going to happen to me, or, well, yeah, it's going to happen to me, but it's going to happen so far in the future, I don't have to deal with it now, so let's just not think about it. That's how we deal, generally, with old age, illness, and death, as we meet it with denial. And Anaglio, monk, said the same thing is true with climate change. It's such a scary prospect. It's so unsettling to us to think of the world dying, the world as we know it, is dying, that we don't think about it. Because we don't think about it, we don't act on it, which is why we're not seeing the kind of action some of us would like to see happening around global warming. People are in such amount of denial about it. I don't know what your experience is, but something I like to talk about. I find people with kids have a harder time talking about it than people that don't have kids. Because they care about they love their kids and they want their kids to have a happy future. So you could say that denial, whether it's of our own mortality or the earth, is the central problem of human condition. Any thoughts on that or questions? Listening to this long bit.
So I'm curious, though Steve Levine has some answers for this, but since you were also talking about pain, so one can be aware of it in present, but it's still unpleasant. So what does one do with that?
So that's the talk about pain that I didn't get. it's a really interesting thing to approach from a mindfulness perspective. Pain is simply a sensation, right? Pain is simply a sensation in the body. And so we start out by noticing, being aware of that sensation. And what we usually, the mindfulness way of dealing with pain is to give it your full attention and notice its characteristics. Is it burning? Is it cold? Is it stabbing? Is it twitching? What's its nature? What that information often reveals is that pain isn't a constant thing. It comes and goes. It's not. I can say that I've had this pain in my foot, which I've had for about 12 hours now, 12 or 15 hours, but it hasn't been constant. It comes and goes. That makes it, that insight makes it not quite so hard to deal with, realizing it's coming and going. Sometimes pain is so intense that you can't put your attention on. And you all may have had experience at one time or another, with pain. It's just so bad, you just can't sit with it in that way. So the other technique that we do with mindfulness with pain is to notice some part of you that's not in pain. So if my foot is just bothering me too much, if it's just excruciatingly painful, which it was a couple of times, then I can notice my right elbow or my left knee, or the rest of my body is generally at peace. That brings some peace. You can notice those aspects of yourself that are not in pain. That's also true of emotional pain. Same techniques can be used with grief or anger or fear. You can have fear about this, but not fear about whatever it is, this pain or worrying about old age or death, but sitting in this room. Most of us, it's not a fearful thing. I used to lead a sitting group of the Zen Hospice Project, and it wasn't just for people that were in the hospice who were actively dying. It was for anybody, this was during the AIDS epidemic, it was for anybody that had a life-threatening illness. Many people with AIDS came from outside. And that was kind of the theme of the group. And one of the things we did, so everybody in the room had some life-threatening issue, pretty much. Everybody had a big issue in their life, usually about death or illness. And one of the things we would do is we would look at the information that's provided to us. The only real information we have in our lives in the present moment is coming to us from our five senses. The Buddha said there were six senses, including the mind. So looking at sitting here in this room, looking at our sense of touch, our sense of hearing, our sense of sight, our sense of taste, our sense of smell, and thoughts arising and passing, not the contents of thoughts, but just thoughts arising and passing, ask yourself a question, what's wrong in this moment? Using only that criteria, not thinking. Seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, tasting, thoughts arising and passing without contents of thoughts, what's the matter in this moment? So ask yourself that question. When we ask that to a room of people with AIDS or cancer or that were dying, most of them couldn't say that there was anything wrong in the moment. So it's a different way of looking at your experience. If we have a life-threatening disease, I have AIDS, I've had AIDS for 30 years. If I sat around all the time thinking, oh my God, I've got AIDS, I'm going to die, and when's it going to happen? Well, I probably would have died 25 years ago, because that would have just killed me, having that kind of dukkha in my mind. But there's much to life besides having a life-threatening illness. So right now, in this moment, even with a throbbing foot, even with a life-threatening disease, I'm probably as happy and content as I've ever been in my life, and that's because of my practice. And the practice is as simple as paying attention, very careful attention, to your six senses in the present moment. That's really all there is to this meditation business, is giving very careful, non-judgmental attention to your six senses in the present moment. What's going on?
I'm missing a sense. What's the sixth sense?
Sixth sense is the mind. The mind. But not thinking. It's the noticing mind. So the mind can notice even thinking, arising, passing in the current moment. We can notice that we're thinking. But that's not the same as kind of engaging with thinking. Because if we notice with thinking, we just notice thoughts arising, passing, coming and going. I don't know what you do in your meditation. There's probably as many different meditations going on, types of meditation going on as there are people in this room. But my meditation is simply noticing the arising and passing of thoughts until they kind of wear themselves out. But I probably had dozens of thoughts arise and pass away during the course of my meditation. It's just that none of them stuck. So in meditation, we don't try to block out thoughts. We don't try to stop thinking. We just don't feed it. We don't give it. We don't give it any power.
So just to follow up that, other than some interesting examples, I think. So the mind is noticing, but what we generally do with it is interpretation.
Yeah.
So an example would be various kinds of music. So some people like this kind or that kind and say, one person says this is awful, and a lot of it depends on where you were brought up, whether it's the music of your culture or tribe or not. Another example, which I'm having some experience of, is knee arthritis. So a mysterious thing about knee arthritis, which I've now talked to numerous orthopedists about, is some people have bone on bone, no cartilage, and they go trotting around without much difficulty and without much, if any, pain. And the orthopedists don't understand it, but the last one I talked to said, well, it's how it's interpreted by the mind. So it's certain sensations, and then some people may have also encountered something called a TENS device, which is something electrical, dural stimulation, and so what that does is it gives too many pain sensations and the brain gets tired of interpreting it, so it, you know, it stops calling those things pain.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's it's life is interpretation.
Yeah.
The Buddha talked about that too. The Buddha, when the Buddha talks about the world, and he uses that expression quite a lot in his teachings, he talks about the world. But he goes on to say, the world is something we create in our minds. That, you know, my world is different than your world, and even sitting in the same room, sharing the same space together, we're so prejudiced by our implicit biases and our background and how we were raised and what we believe in and what practices we do, that our worlds are really quite different things. Please.
I mean, that kind of sort of feeds off of all of that, but you were talking in your talk about like how the Buddha said about creation of the world, and it brought me a memory, like, I was 16 years old in Orange County, because you're talking about, like, our gay ancestors, too. So there's this person who was born a man and was, like, a football player, but then later in his life realized, or came out as transgender or whatever. So it's, like, this big, bulky person who's transitioning into being a woman, and this is like 96, 98, something like that. Anyways, and it was the first gay pride in Orange County, and I begged my brother to take me, so I went. And then there's like people like, you're gonna burn in hell, blah, blah. And he said, you create your heaven, you create your hell right now, right here. Your decisions is to make this seem like hell, but for me, this is heaven, honey.
That's what I'm saying. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
We create our own heaven, we create our own hell. Michael.
The denial of impermanence, with maybe death being its most glaring manifestation. What do you think the connection is to compassion? Because it seems to me that our shared experience of impermanence is partly where compassion comes from.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there's a lot of denial about that, then it seems to me like it would be more challenging to feel connected to other people with compassion.
Yeah, that's my experience. And acknowledging our own fear of change connects us with other people. Two things about that is compassion is, as I've said before, and you probably know, that the English word compassion comes from Latin with suffering. So if you understand your own suffering, your own fear, your own tendencies to denial, if we can see into that, then we it helps us see that everybody shares that. That resistance to unreliability, the first noble truths, first two noble truths, resistance to unreliability, is a universal thing, and it's something we all share. So I can have a lot more compassion for somebody else's denial when I realize, oh, I used to have that too, or I still do have that too, I still share that. So that's one way that compassion happens, is to realize that my suffering is the universal suffering. A friend of mine, in fact, John Martin tells this story. John Martin's a teacher that has been here before. And he was having I know he's told this story, so I can repeat it. He was having an interview with Joseph Goldstein, a really wonderful Buddhist teacher, during the retreat. And he was going on about his trauma in his life. And Joseph just kind of had a blank face. And when he was done talking about his trauma, Joseph said, "And your suffering is the reflection of the suffering of the world." And it took John a while to realize. You know, he thought, "Well, that wasn't very compassionate." But then later on in the retreat, I think maybe the next day, he thought, "Oh, I'm not so special. Trauma's pretty universal. It's something that a lot of us share. Not the same trauma, but we've all had some kind of trauma in our lives. That's something that's pretty universal. That allows us to have compassion. The second thing that I want to say about compassion is the way is compassion should be our own response to ourselves for our own suffering. And it might be sounding like I don't mean to sound like it's really easy to simply give up our grief, our sorrow, our attachments to having things be in a certain way. But when we notice that, when we notice we have grief or sorrow or difficulty or we're struggling with something, we can have compassion for ourselves. And so maybe that's the first step. Is to go, oh, this is suffering. This is dukkha. Whatever you're feeling, don't try to change it right away. Don't try to make it go away. Don't even rationalize, as I hope you don't think I'm suggesting rationalizing away suffering in your life. Oh, it'll go away. But sometimes you just have to be with it and have compassion. This is suffering. Suffering's like this.
Could you repeat the words of Joseph Goldstein?
Your suffering is the suffering of the world. Suffering is the universal.
Yeah. Stephen Levine talks about suffering in that way too. He would say, you know, at some point my pain becomes the pain. We all know pain.
Yeah.
And certainly suffering or fear is universal.
Yeah.
Like, it not only makes me feel compassion, but I'm not alone. It's the suffering.
It connects you with everybody.
Yeah.
Because the opposite of that, and what we usually do is, oh man, I'm in pain, and I'm special. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my thing.
Yeah.
And I'm different than you because I've got this pain, or I'm.
Nobody knows what I'm going through.
Yeah. Nobody knows what I'm going through. It's an ego thing. It's mm-hmm. You know, we meet our suffering and thinking that it's something special to us.
Yeah.
But it's not. It's suffering is universal.
I brought this up in the past. If you could say a few words about forgiveness. And it was interesting, I was at Peter Weissman's retreat 2 weeks ago. And because we were in double silence, I wrote on a piece of paper to her And then what she, her response was to do, in the evening, do a forgiveness meditation, which is actually very helpful, and which was a lot like the meta meditation that I've done through this. But I just know that I feel as if a lot of us suffering these days with the politics of things and the way our politicians are behaving, particularly Republican leadership, to say it in this room, that I'm sort of struggling with how to hold all of that. Compassion isn't quite doing it for me, I think, but I know there as well. But can you say a few words about forgiveness, or maybe you can frame it somehow differently?
Yeah, well, there is a forgiveness practice, which is what I assume she was describing to you, and it does have phrases like metta. But for me, what forgiveness is about is realizing that we're all not very good at this, getting through life business. We make mistakes. We all, and this is where it overlaps with compassion, we all simply want to be happy, right? It's basically, that's one thing we all have in common, is we want to be happy, we want to be healthy, we want to be free. And we all go about it trying to manage that in different ways. And some people create harm doing that. So you mentioned politics. I try not to think about the politicians too much, but I think about their supporters. People, you know, poor people in Appalachia and red states that don't have jobs and don't have educations and don't have a lot of hope for how they're going to get on in the world, and they're frightened. And that causes them to vote for people that might have different values than we do. But we might be frightened too. So, and we might share that fear. We don't know what's happening with the world. And it seems very unsettling and very unsteady now for everybody. And so we're all coming at it from these different perspectives. And some people I get judgmental about, but I can also have compassion for that. They're just trying to be happy. They're just trying to organize their lives in a way that's good for them. So I can forgive them for that. It doesn't mean I agree with them, but I can forgive them. And likewise, I can forgive myself for all the inexpert ways that I've tried to promote my own happiness, sometimes at the expense of other people. In a nutshell, that's how I work with forgiveness.
I just want to say that I've always held those who voted for the leadership with a lot of compassion. I've never felt any anger towards those folks, because I accept that their struggles, as you're describing them. I just, you know, not to belabor too much, but just to say that it's those folks who, supposed to stand for some sense of principle, some sense of decency. Our leaders, it's the leadership that expects something different.
And yeah, the trouble with politicians is of both sides, all sides, is it takes a lot of ego to do that job. And there's a lot of big egos that they're also trying to make themselves happy. You know, maybe making a lot of money will make me happy, or maybe having a lot of power will make me happy. But that's just another delusion. So maybe you can even have some compassion for those people. I know it's not so easy. By the way, any other thoughts on working with people that might not share our views? David?
I think there's opportunity to check our own expectations of other people. And like, when we get upset at people, it's usually some kind of, we carried some expectation of them in that we held that it didn't get meet. So it is a very self-centered experience when we're upset at other people. not to say we aren't, you know, sometimes people are harmed, right? Or, you know, threatened, you know, that's real. But with the politics piece, this has occurred to me, you know, hearing you talk, is like, it's a very patriarchal experience of looking to, like, daddy, you know, to, like, take care of us, and then they let us down. And so there's an opportunity to be like, what is it in our conditioning to think that they would operate any different than any of us sitting in this room? That they're like thinking for themselves, or like they're operating from their own belief structure, like we all are. So like, yes, we hold them to a higher accountability, but kind of why? You know, like,
good question.
Why? I mean, I don't know. It's just like kind of checking and question ourselves of we get set up in a way, and we set them up too,
yeah,
in that capacity.
Yeah.
And I think with that, we can maybe take on more responsibility for their behavior in a way. I don't know. And it made me think about the global, I mean, you know, it's something that's like kind of connected with you're talking about global warming. It made me think about renunciation a lot, of like we don't talk about it very often, but somewhere along the line, renunciation comes into our own freedom. Because we, you know, when we suddenly say, oh, I'm no longer, like, I suddenly see impermanence, and I see every single person or every living thing is the exact, like equal, like, I gotta change some stuff. Like, I gotta let some behaviors go,
yeah,
to really live, if I'm really, like, it's gonna change. And so with global warming, I think that's another piece of it, is like, there's a renunciation piece that's very, very difficult for us to move towards because of what it asks us if we don't really, really see the stakes. But I think in the same way with the politics too, it's kind of, it's tricky.
Well,
stuff.
And particularly in a capitalist society, right? Renunciation,
yeah,
is like is the opposite of that. It's, we've been trained our entire lives to do more, make,
yeah,
more, create more, get more,
mm-hmm,
have,
yes,
more, and consume.
When you say renunciation, are you saying renunciation of what?
Whatever's
of
in
the world
way,
or of greed,
well,
or
it's there's a lot of different. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say it's like whatever is in the way of acting in accordance to the values of compassion, seeing everyone truly as equal, not contributing to harming the planet. You know, I mean, I always just
go harming each other.
Or harming, I mean, my my metaphor is always like take out food. Like that whole thing in San Francisco is like the biggest thing in the world, but it's probably one of the worst things for our environment we could even imagine right now. You know, in terms of the litter. And so it's like we have to, like, the conveniences that we build up around ourselves are the very thing that's really like really problematic, you know. And so,
another way that that renunciation is talked about in Buddhism is part of right intention. It's part of the renunciation is part of the Eightfold Path. The definition I like is renunciation is letting go of whatever gets in the way of what makes you happy, whatever brings happiness. And if you truly look deeply, what brings us happiness is not stuff. It's compassion and forgiveness and love and acceptance. So renunciation is a beautiful thing. It's just not something that's built into our culture. We have a very greedy, greed-based culture.
I think we have to wrap it up. So thank you, David, for sharing your wisdom and your Buddha nature with us. Do you have any announcements?
I do. I'm the host today, so please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha. There are some sweet treats, which might be heaven, it might be hell. there's some banana bread that David has contributed. There are cookies. The cookies are all vegan, with the exception that some people consider white sugar to be not vegan because it's filtered through bone char, and so the chocolate chip cookies have some white sugar in them. But the other ones are kosher? No, they're not kosher. they're vegan. Let's see. Dana is the way the Sangha supports ourselves, how we pay for the rent for this fabulous place, how we pay for the newsletter, which comes out several times a year, pays for the lunches that we make for unhoused, homeless youth.
Dinner.
I'm sorry. Oh, yes, right. And that pays for our own Dana to offer to speakers who come and share their wisdom with us. So please give generously as you can. $20 is a great number, if more or less according to what works for you. 12:30, some people gather at the front door to lunch, and anybody's welcome to join them. There's a sign-up sheet to get on our email list over on the credenza. And I have a couple of things. David, you mentioned Hal Hershey's passing. There's going to be a memorial for Hal on November 17th, 3 weeks from today. Yeah, 3 weeks from today at the Columbarium in San Francisco. So there's information on a flyer out on the coffee table. And 2 weeks from now, some Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence will be coming to do the Dharma talk. And the title of the talk is Fuck Coping, Reclaiming Liberation in a Time of Mindfulness. It's on the subject of kind of appropriation by capitalism of the Dharma, of aspects of the Dharma, and of practice. And so Sister Mary Peter has offered a few readings, if anybody's interested, beforehand. So there's a flyer, some materials that could provoke an interesting discussion. So that'll be in 2 weeks from today.
Thank you, guys.
And next week, unless I didn't get another memo, is Alistair Shanks. And there's a long bio here that I'll read to you next week, since I'm your facilitator again. I'll host next week as well.
Another note, the book group is meeting Sunday, November 10th, and we're reading the first half of a book called There, There, by Tommy Orange, which is about a fiction about Oakland and from a Native American person's perspective of leaving Oakland and coming back and the changes that happened. So.
Anybody else? You can gather in a circle for the dedication of marriage. By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers, so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.